This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'd like to thank Karen very much for that introduction, except for the part that makes me feel like a grandmother. But I'd like to definitely thank her very much for her invitation here and her kind hospitality. And I'd also like to thank Aaron Levy for providing this space. I've been actually trying to get to the Slout Foundation for quite a while, and now I feel glad that I'm finally here. I'm very excited by some of the posters I see and the kinds of things that are being done here. It's really a great resource. I've never actually been to Penn, or to Philadelphia for that matter, so this is also a first in that respect. The paper I'm going to read is actually a kind of merger of two research projects that I've been thinking about and pursuing for the past couple of years, one much more avidly than the other. The first is an investigation of scale and the transformation of scale in relation to the measure of the human body in modernity specifically, and also specifically in its incarnation in the cinema with its quality of being bigger than life, or its alleged quality of being bigger than life. And the second project is actually kind of on the back burner right now. I haven't done a lot with it, but it surfaces here, especially in the beginning of the talk, as you'll see. It has to do with a project I'd like to do someday on the relations between mass culture and the avant-garde. And I know that that's, in a way, a well-worn question or research topic, but I think there's still more there that can be investigated. And I'm specifically interested in their alleged antagonism, the antagonism between mass culture and the avant-garde, and their interrelations, and also to a large extent their complicities with one another. So this paper is entitled Screening the Avant-Garde Face. In an essay entitled The Sublime and the Avant-Garde, Jean-François Lyotard problematizes the notion, it is happening. He connects the dismantling of the unthought acceptance of the certainty of the event, something we tend to associate with the document or the documentary, to art, and specifically to the project of the avant-garde. The avant-garde dissects the integrity and homogeneity of the event, the it, but also the notion of happening. What can it mean to happen, to take place? And it is precisely this kind of interrogation of an everyday certainty, of a seemingly unquestionable banality, that has drawn various feminisms historically to the avant-garde. The avant-garde was a crucial concern in the 1970s and early 80s during the heyday of theory within feminist film studies. In visual pleasure and narrative cinema, most famously perhaps, Laura Mulvey characterized the avant-garde as a negation of Hollywood cinema's complicity in the patriarchal ordering of sexual difference. Quote, the first blow against the monolithic accumulation of traditional film conventions already undertaken by radical filmmakers is to free the look of the camera into its materiality in time and space, and the look of the audience into dialectics, passionate detachment, unquote. Much of the feminist film practice of the 1970s and 80s, and I'm thinking here of films like those of Mulvey and Wolin, Sally Potter's Thriller of 1979, Babette Mangold's What Maisie Knew, 1976, and Sigmund Freud's Dora, 1979, allied itself with the avant-garde through a project of negation, a systematic interrogation and undermining of classical codes of sexual looking and imaging. It is this negativity at the heart of an affirmation of feminism that is most intriguing. Yet it was often a negativity lodged in formal categories, susceptible to the tendency to equate aesthetic radicalism with political radicalism, collapsing politics into aesthetics. As Andrew Hewitt has pointed out, quote, once political judgments can be displaced onto formal considerations, Once a text can be called progressive by virtue of its formal qualities, and that judgment extended to its political aspects, the political itself becomes superfluous as a critical tool, unquote. One of the difficulties of the feminist advocacy of the avant-garde in the 1970s lay ironically in its local approach, in its failure to situate these films in the larger theoretical context of a history of the avant-garde. The theory of the avant-garde and its history is potentially useful to feminism because it has been haunted by the insistent question of the autonomy of art and the desire to forge a link between aesthetics and politics. In other and stronger words, it should not be possible to accept the feminist assumption of an intimate articulation of aesthetics and politics, especially insofar as it has historically privileged the avant-garde as an alternative realm, outside of a thorough examination of the history of debates about aesthetic autonomy. Peter Berger traces a history whereby art becomes increasingly autonomous with the breakdown of its connections to religion and court life. The apex of the autonomy is 19th century aestheticism and the art for art's sake movement, which involved a rupture of the relation between art and everyday life. Art hence comes to constitute a separate realm characterized precisely by its social ineffectivity. The historical avant-garde, movements of the 1920s such as Surrealism and Dada, attacked the institution of art for this insularity and tried to reconnect art and praxis. It failed, in Berger's argument, but succeeded in revealing the institutional status of art. Nevertheless, institutionalized as art themselves, assimilated within the world of the museum, such movements were stripped of any political valence. The rationalization characterizing capitalist modernity produced a process of differentiation within the public sphere that, among other effects, separated and distinguished aesthetics and politics. From one point of view, this autonomy isolated art from mass culture and hence the capitalist circuit of commodity exchange, allowing it to serve as a space of resistance or critique. It's probably better to look at Vertigo than that screensaver. On the other hand, such autonomy and specialization, deprived of effectivity, are no real escape and can easily be seen as part of the rationalization strategies of capitalism. According to Hewitt, the 20th century witnessed a shift in modes of legitimating the autonomy of art. The earlier mode, the structural legitimation strategy, which Hewitt associates with the Frankfurt School, described art as an outlet from capitalist reification that allowed it to satisfy residual needs. The strategy that displaced it was a specifically aesthetic one, a mimetic one by means of which fragmentation in art, in modernism, the avant-garde, was perceived as a true or accurate representation of fragmentation in everyday life. Aaron, the light is suddenly in my eyes. Do you know why that would be? Is it because I turned this back on? Or maybe I can move a little bit. It's full screen.
That's not better.
Yeah, it is. Thank you. Technical genius. For Hewitt, all of this points to the fact that the problem of modernity is not a crisis or collapse of representation or of the mimetic tradition, but rather its retention. I do not have the space here to work out all the ramifications of this history of thinking about the avant-garde for film feminisms, but I am citing it in order to raise a number of questions. What are the ways in which aesthetics and politics have been figured in relation to each other? What are the grounds of their separation and the resultant attempts to bridge that distance? How has the avant-garde been thought as both site of resistance and the failure of resistance? What are the relations between the avant-garde and mass culture with respect to questions of autonomy? If the division between aesthetics and politics is produced through processes of capitalist rationalization, can we simply force a merger? The tendency to polarize the avant-garde and mass culture intermittently throughout the 20th century has had a negative impact on our understanding of the intricate relations and complicities between the two. This situation has been recognized and addressed by a number of theorists, including Andreas Heussen and Jonathan Crary, among others, but I would like to focus here on a particular aspect of this relationship that figures critical intersections between technologies, faces, subjectivities, and knowledges, one that is, of course, inflected by understandings of sexual difference, and one whose reading is also informed by the current interest in archaeologies of technologies, especially of mechanical and electronic reproduction. The technology here is the seemingly basic and simple one of the screen, one that we tend to take for granted as having the minor role of substrate and support of a representation. Yet we are surrounded by screens today, screens of varying sizes, from the miniature screens of cell phones, iPods, and Palm Pilots, to the medium screens of computers and televisions, to the gigantic screens of IMAX, which is the abbreviation of image maximum. The screen haunts both private and public realms. Miniaturized, the image it bears can now literally be held in the hand, sustaining the illusion of its possession. Made gigantic in IMAX theaters, it presents the spectator with a vision of impossible totality, of modern transcendence. The screen is the largely unthought ground of imagistic representation in both mass culture and the avant-garde, excluding various early experiments with split screen, widescreen, and multiple screen processes, and at least until the advent of the notion of expanded cinema in the 1960s and 70s. In the realm of mass culture, the screen was for a very long time simply a synonym for the cinema. The Oxford English Dictionary cites a 1915 reference in a film magazine to screen fever. But the term precedes the emergence of cinema, and as the OED outlines, was initially used to denote a form of concealment or protection. The first definition given is, quote, a contrivance for warding off the heat of a fire or a draft of air, unquote. Examples of this that are given in the OED range from 1393 to 1899. In the 17th and 18th centuries, small handheld screens, often with decoration, were produced to shield ladies' faces from the fire. These screens were also like fans, according to Erki Huhtamo, and acted as, quote, objects of fashion, aesthetic pleasure, and erotic play. Veiling one's face behind a hand screen incited desire and curiosity, like a mask. Hiding and revealing were indistinguishable aspects of this screen play, unquote. The protection extended to other potentially dangerous or uncomfortable threats, including the gaze. The semantic transformation from barrier or defense to ground or support of images seems to have been consolidated with the projection of images in magic lanterns and phantasmagoria. The OED cites a reference from 1810, quote, to make transparent screens for the exhibition of the phantasmagoria, unquote. The term screen came to denote a surface or support for the exhibition of images. The etymological trajectory of the word traces a movement from a technology designed to protect a woman's face from fire or the male gaze to a technology designed to intercept a beam of light in order to make images visible on a mass scale, enabling an industry that would thrive on the exhibition of the female face. There is an insistent and recurrent scene in Hollywood narrative cinema that plays out certain permutations of screening, identity, knowledge, and the female face. In it, a male character, constantly on the lookout for a lost object of desire, sees from behind a woman with the same hairdo as that of his lost love, and with great anticipation approaches her only to find, when she turns her face toward him, that she is not the one he sought. Now, I'm indebted to Joe Milutis for having called my attention to this scenario, and he has actually a wonderful website on the face, and which is generated to some extent from this scenario. And if anyone is interested, I can give you that website afterwards. The example that I'm going to show is unfortunately a very familiar one from Vertigo. And I say unfortunate not only because a lot of you will already be familiar with it, but because it's not entirely typical of the scenario, which usually takes place in a large city, on the street, in a crowd. And in Vertigo, that's not quite the case. But the trope of misrecognition is very strong here.
I bought it from a man who used to live here in this apartment building, Mr. Gavin Elster. I bought it from him when he moved away. Oh, you knew him and his wife, the poor thing.
Okay, I'll show one more.
Good evening.
One more example.
Good evening.
In this recurring scenario, the intensity of the desire is often marked by a frenetic chase or a tracking shot moving steadily toward the woman. Often this happens in an urban setting, on the street, in the midst of crowds of nameless and unknown passersby, invoking the uniquely modern cliché of the faceless crowd. According to Miletus, quote, the city's relation to the face, the major trope of which is the faceless crowd, is productive of one of the great clichés of the movies, unquote. In the midst of overwhelming anonymity of the faceless crowd, only one face will do, and it is one that is tauntingly suggested but absent. This scene resonates with a crisis of knowledge and knowability and can be found in films as varied as The Fabulous Baker Boys, 1989, Funny Face, 1957, My Fair Lady, 1964, as well as Vertigo, 1958. It marks a trauma of recognition, desire, and loss circulating around the face as screen for the projection of a memory and as screened. But it is a trauma that is not unique to the Hollywood narrative cinema, although it may be here that it finds the terms of its most explicit enunciation as psychological trauma embedded within the narrative. The avant-garde has also historically struggled with issues of recognition, the vacillation of knowability and unknowability, visibility and invisibility, and the screen as support of the image. And much of this interrogation has, interestingly enough, circulated around the representation or representability of the female face as screen. The notion of the screen in cinema is indissociable from conceptions of light, projection, and materiality and immateriality. As Dominique Paini has pointed out, the concept of projection combines spectacle, the action of projecting images on a screen, and geometry, the representation of a volume on a flat surface. According to Paini, and from an art historical perspective, the image can be produced in two ways, through its attachment to a material support. He's thinking here of painting, frescoes, and the like, but one could also add optical toys, or through the interception of a beam of light by a surface, the screen, that is totally foreign to the image. In the first case, the image is made visible through direct or ambient light. In the second, the image is, quote, dependent on the light that traverses the transparent veil of its support. In this other history, Light no longer encounters an image, nor bathes it, nor illuminates it. Light penetrates it at first, then transports it, duplicates it in dematerializing it, sometimes temporalizing and sublimating it. Since the projection of an image mixes in a single composite, the image and the light necessary for its exhibition, it associates representing and exhibiting. Vision equals light, and light is identified with the sense of sight, unquote. Projection of the illusion of motion collapses representation and exhibition and calls up the notion of spectacle. It magnifies the image whose scale is no longer dominated by the scale of a body, but by that of an architecture, of the abstract authority of spectacle and a collective public life. Writing in 1925, Laszlo Moholy-Nagy foregrounded light as the medium of photography and film. Light was not so much dematerializing as a new material, no longer that which simply facilitated access to other, seemingly more material objects. His experiments with photograms, photographic images made without a camera in which the objects are placed directly on a photosensitive material and exposed to light, made light both agent and mold of the representation. In his short film, Ein Lichtspiel Schwarz-Weiß-Grau, or Light Play, Black, White, and Gray of 1930, recognition of the material object or its parts is completely subordinated to the tracing and recording of the play of projected and reflected light and shadow. And I'm going to show you just a short part of that film. More radically, perhaps, in his theoretical writings, Moholy-Nagy envisaged a utopian future which would attach the greatest importance to kinetic projected composition, probably even with interpenetrating beams and masses of light floating freely in the room without a direct plane of projection. The instruments will continually be improved so that it will be able to embrace far larger fields of tension, unquote. He also imagined a projection plane divided into different obliquely positioned planes and a projection screen in the shape of a sphere or a segment of a sphere instead of the traditional flat rectangular screen. In this construct, more than one film could be projected simultaneously, and most intriguingly, these films would not be projected onto a fixed location of the screen, but the process of projection itself would be mobile, freed from the rigidity of convention. The historical avant-garde produced a host of other experiments with light and projection, including the films of Richter and Egling, Man Ray and Fernand Léger, as well as Marcel Duchamp's Anemic Cinema of 1926. Not infrequently, these experiments deployed the female face or body in a privileged manner as screen, as support of the play of light and image. Man Ray's Le Retour à la Raison, 1923, cuts from a suspended geometric mobile, spinning and producing a play of shadows on the wall behind, to the torso of a woman, itself the receptacle of, or screen for, the performance of light and shadow. You just have to bear with me a moment as I change the DVD. The cut here, that is the cut between the spinning mobile and the torso of the woman, the cut here marks a significant conjunction, a bleeding of meaning between object and subject, representation and screen, projection and surface. The first shots trace the turn of the mobile, its shadow separate from itself, doubling its movement on the wall behind. Different shots of the turning mobile and its shadow are superimposed. After the cut, the turn, or the trope of the turn, is taken up and reiterated by the naked torso of a woman at a window, her body acting as a screen to support the swirling play of light and shadow. No face, no limbs, just the merger of an eroticized and simultaneous fascination with breasts and with forms. The recognizability of the female body as female is not lost. To the contrary, that body is both support and supplement for representation. Le Retour à la Raison as a whole is a film obsessed with form and with the action of light and the impressionability of surfaces. Many of the shots are rayograms, Monet's version of the photogram. Heidegger, for whom the dialectic between concealing and revealing is fundamental, and whose work is permeated by metaphors of visuality, discusses the concept of the shadow in the age of the world picture. Quote, "Everyday opinion sees in the shadow only the lack of light, if not the light's complete denial. In truth, however, the shadow is a manifest, though impenetrable, testimony to the concealed emitting of light. In keeping with this concept of shadow, we experience the incalculable as that which, withdrawn from representation, is nevertheless manifest in whatever is, pointing to being which remains concealed," unquote. For Heidegger, technology in the age when the world becomes picture is aligned with quantification, measurability, calculability, with the production in modernity of the object and objectivity over and against the subject of certainty and knowledge, of in effect the subject-object split. The avant-garde purports to interrogate cinema as the technology of light and shadow and of movement's representation. It interrogates as well everyday opinion, which, quote, "sees in the shadow only the lack of light, if not light's complete denial," unquote. While it would be hazardous to apply Heidegger's categories of light and shadow directly to this film or any film, it is also possible, indeed necessary, I think, to note that Le Retour à la Raison struggles with the concept of the object and its representability, struggles with mimesis and its relation to a dialectic of light and shadow, and in the course of doing so, produces the female body as screen as both access and defense in part against capitulation to a vision of the whole. In Monet's Imak Bakia, which translates as Leave Me Alone, 1926, on the other hand, it is the face of the woman that becomes the surface of display. And I have a few clips from Imak Bakia. Tom. Undulating lights and forms incapable of retaining fixed or legible shapes precede and overlay the face of the first woman, which is itself, with its prominent makeup, explicitly a painted surface. The fleeting reflections generated by a revolving cube are projected onto the face of the second woman, who, like the first, stares directly at the camera. The flower that introduces the image of the third woman becomes a shape projected onto a face that unhesitatingly and directly confronts the camera. All these shots foreground the act of opening one's eyes, while the plastic mannequin-like quality of the third female figure is produced by doubling the representation of the eyes, using the eyelid itself as the carrier of the image. The essential artificiality is flattened even further when her face becomes the screen for another image of her own face, upside down, now assuming the undulations and malleability of the original lights and forms. For the historical avant-garde, emerging during the early years of film with an unbridled optimism about its possibilities, it was the very conditions of cinema, light, projection, movement, screen, that were at stake. But the excessively formal nature of these concerns seemed to require for its support a particular conceptualization of the female face, by definition, the white Western female face. It was the face of the modern woman, open, almost geometric in its clarity, serving to double the capacities of the screen while signaling a certain historical specificity. For the woman's close affiliation with fashion aligns her with the perpetual production and redefinition of the new, with modernity itself. And as each new modern era redefines itself as new, the modern Western woman reemerges as the incarnation of the fashionable moment, whatever it might happen to be. Bangs, straight hair, curly hair, short or long hair, thin eyebrows, thick eyebrows, etc. To see the woman is in some sense to recognize most effectively and instantaneously the historical moment. In the 1960s and 1970s, this woman materializes most prominently in the avant-garde in the work of Andy Warhol and Jean-Luc Godard. The fascination of the historical avant-garde, of Moholy-Nage, of Leger, of Man Ray and Duchamp, with light, reflection, and projection, can be seen as an engagement with the intensive thinking of location and bodies in relation to location, at the moment of the emergence of a cinematographic modernity. In the 1960s and 1970s, the filmic avant-garde, in a return to what it viewed as the ur-cinema, or the cinema before its rigidification by Hollywood classicism, and in a move deeply influenced by the historical avant-garde, resuscitated an obsession with projection and with light as medium. Andy Warhol's fixed camera stare was reminiscent of Lumiere, and he persistently explored the vicissitudes of different modes and manners of projecting his films. The 1966 Chelsea Girls makes use of two projectors and of complex lighting schemes, coupled with the insistence upon a scriptless scenario of pure improvisation on the part of the actors. It is made up of 12 scenarios, single shots, of 30 minutes each, two projected simultaneously at all times. The specific configuration of each individual screening of this film is unique, given the inevitably different rates of changing reels on the part of the projectionists. Unfortunately, the DVD fixes the relation of the right screen to the left screen, and it thereby erases the original appeal to contingency in the screening situation, which was dependent upon the movements of the projectionist different to each screening. The final scenario on the left, beginning with Nico crying, is an extended play with light, projection, and the face as screen. And I'm going to show this parts of this scene is very long, and I just want to show you part of the beginning, the middle, and the end to give you a sense of it. The DVD also deviates from the very strict projection instructions that are given in the screening of the 16-millimeter print when the film is rented, in which the projectionist is instructed to begin one reel certain number of minutes after the other reel. I forget exactly how many, so that the reels are out of phase, so that at the end of what you're seeing is really the last two reels. And you'll see Nico on the left and Ondine on the right. But when it's shown according to the strict projection instructions, you only see, for a large, large period of this time, you only see Nico. And I'm actually going to tell you to concentrate on Nico when you see this, even though you will see on the DVD, you'll see Ondine as well in a very, very funny, you know, little improvisation. The sound is pretty bad, so you really won't be able to make out what he says anyway. But the section that I'm going to talk about is this section on the right with Nico, and specifically the use of her face. Okay, this will be towards the very beginning of the reel, where you have a fairly close-up of Nico, and she's crying.
I have to take my belt off. Because I have to use it. John? All right, I'm
thank you, sir.
After Mother. You smell nice. What are you wearing?
The sacred oil that was in the
what's
in
the name of it? It's beautiful.
I think it's called patchouli.
This is a light meter that she's playing with.
Well,
thank you, sir.
Because the cameras are rolling.
Cameras?
Yes, this is a new kind
cameras
of confession.
Are you kidding?
It's called true confession.
Well, that's kind of scary, you know.
No. It's American way.
Is this really better?
Yes. Nothing is?
My father, I have to confess.
A lot about movies had better be sharp. Testing is really preferable. There's nothing I can do. You can just idolize me. I go right ahead. I'm violent itself, but I'm not at all, really. Only I can't help it, Paul. Do you realize the innocence with which you sent her in here? Perfectly innocently, she started to know what to confess. And then, did you see that? I mean, it's a document. It will remain. Be praised. I knew it would be big, though. I adore myself. I can't bear it. Oh, idolatry. All right, now it's my set. I was supposed to interview a girl on a bicycle, a rather large girl on a bicycle named Bridges. She didn't show up. I think her bike went to fall.
Okay, I have one more clip, but I'm going to skip it in the interest of time. In the beginning of this scene, Nico plays with a tape measure and a light meter, the tools of focus and lighting whose conventions are violently assaulted by the mode of filming. The coincidence of extreme affect, marked by Nico's tears, in excruciatingly close close-up, and an extended and unrepentant camera stare dissolves into the reduction of face and body to a surface, a screen intercepting and displaying the movements of colored lights, textures, and patterns in the mode of strobe lighting so characteristic of the 1960s. The combination of excessively fast zooms in and out with the projected lights and patterns obscuring the face flattens screen space to the point where the face itself becomes the screen, blank space of reception and reflection of light. Much as in Freud's scenario, in a case of paranoia running counter to the psychoanalytic theory of the disease, the contortions of the body become the signs or symptoms of the work of an imaging system or technology, an apparatus of mechanical reproduction. The fragmentation of the projected patterns, combined with the extremity of the close-up, troubles recognition and knowledge in their relation to the human face. Jean-Luc Godard, as well, yokes together the female face and a problematics of the screen and knowability. When Nana, or Anna Karina, in Vivre sa vie, 1962, goes to the cinema, her face in close-up echoes the screen on which Dreyer's Joan of Arc, 1928, is playing. And here I just have a slideshow to show you. And I'm just going to continue talking over this. These are all just shots from Vivre sa vie. A commentary or a critique of the notions of mimesis and identification of Karina with Falconetti, the scene nevertheless resonates with an obsessive attention to faces and facing throughout the film, incarnated in the persistent return to scenes that invoke and adamantly avoid the structure of the shot, reverse shot. Yet it is the credit sequence that most explicitly situates Karina's face as both object of investigation and screen, bearer of writing, and bearer of light and shadow. It is difficult to imagine Godard, or even Warhol, despite his fondness for the transgression of conventional gender identities, assigning the male face a similar function. If I had the time, it would be necessary here to also address the treatment of Jane Fonda's face as the expression of an expression in Godard's Letter to Jane of 1972. What does it mean that these very different avant-garde practices in two historical periods, the 1920s and 1930s on the one hand, and the 1960s and 1970s on the other, what does it mean that they should persistently situate the woman's face as screen? For Hutamo, the screen is a, quote, liminal zone between the material and the immaterial, the real and the virtual, unquote. Much earlier, E.H. Gombrich, in the essay Conditions of Illusion, elaborated a concept of screen in relation to painting as a, quote, empty or ill-defined area onto which the viewer projects his or her expected image, unquote. Far from an insistence upon mimesis or verisimilitude, this is a demand for blankness, illegibility, and absence as the support of illusion. The screen in cinema is a fundamental but almost always unacknowledged basis of representation, intercepting and materializing the image carried by light. The face has also been located as the very ground of representation. Jacques Aumont expounds upon the global significance of the face, which is for him equivalent to the close-up in the cinema, both producing a surface that is simultaneously sensible and legible. The face is the very origin of representation insofar as it is founded upon resemblance and identity. When we say that someone resembles or does not resemble someone else, or oneself for that matter, we are referring above all to the face. According to Aumont, quote, all representation is really inaugurated by the desire of man to figure himself as face. In addition, the phrase, it resembles, is the first experience of representation. What we call representation is nothing other than the more or less complicated history of that resemblance, of its hesitation between two poles, that of appearances, of the visible, of the phenomenon, of representative analogy, and that of interiority, or the invisible, or of the beyond the visible, of the being of expressive analogy. The face is the point of departure and the point of anchorage of this entire history. It is not possible to represent without representing the face of man, unquote. The grandiose or totalizing tendencies of these statements are evidenced by the return of the term man used in a generic sense. For Béla Balázs, the cinematic close-up compensates for the fact that a technology, the printing press, effectively rendered the faces of man, and again that's his term, rendered the faces of man illegible by providing an intense form of mediation. His words document a crisis of legibility, recognition, and knowledge around the face, a crisis that is linked to the proliferation of technologies of representation. In the 20th century, hysteria, as the emblematic pathology of the 19th century, gives way to prosopagnosia, sometimes referred to as face blindness. Prosopagnosia is a pathological condition characterized by an impairment in the ability to recognize faces. Although cases of these symptoms were described in the 19th century by Hulings, Jackson, and Charcot, the condition was first named by Joachim Bodamer, a German neurologist, in 1947, deriving the term from the classical Greek prosopon, or face, and agnosia, meaning non-knowledge. Prosopagnosia is not sexually differentiated in the medical literature, although it is extremely relevant that the facial recognition test produced by the Prosopagnosia Research Center at Harvard and University College London, and you can go to this online if you want to, uses only the faces of women as the testing ground for the level of the pathological condition. To be fair, there are two tests on this website. The first is whether you can recognize new faces, and these are all women, and the other is faces of celebrities, which is both men and women. And I did amazingly poorly on that one. It's very embarrassing. Anxieties about the face and the potential diminishing of its power address not only a destabilization of representation, but of intersubjectivity as well. In the work of Emmanuel Levinas, the face is theorized as the very instantiation of the ethical relation and of intersubjectivity. The face is the marker of absolute otherness, infinite and irreducible alterity. It exceeds any possible means of appropriation, including the attempted containments of vision, knowledge, theory, which Levinas associates with an economy of the same. But what can this mean in relation to the close-up of the face in film? Levinas's interest in the face is ineluctably linked to the extent to which the face, quote, breaks through the form that nevertheless delimits it, unquote. It does this through the reversibility of the gaze. I not only look at it, try to contain it, that is the face, as an image, it looks back, it speaks to me, and exceeds whatever image I might have of it. According to Levinas, the presentation of the other to the same, which is the definition of the face, is, quote, without the intermediary of any image or sign, unquote. His analysis of the face is a philosophical treatment of the originary importance of the face-to-face encounter, of its operation as the ground of sociality and of ethics. In the cinema, there is no such face-to-face encounter. The face in close-up, by definition, cannot respond to me, cannot present itself to me as an obligation or responsibility. It does not inhabit the same time as myself. What are the ethics of the technological reproduction of the face? And why morality? Why ethics? Is it coincidental that the philosophical and theoretical obsession with the face emerges in an era of intensified mediation of that face, in an era often seen as characterized by the loss or diminishment of that face-to-face encounter, that direct and unmediated conversation in which the face breaks through form, in an era of the interface. In Hollywood narrative film, the male character in search of the lost object of desire is subjected over and over again to the trauma of misrecognition, to the literal and metaphorical turn whereby the woman he confronts is not the one he knows, wants, or expects. Avant-garde film provides a mirror image of this conundrum, its articulation in the vocabulary of formalism or aesthetics. But here, in place of a missed or aborted recognition, we have the dismantling or putting into crisis of recognizability as such, the imaging of the woman as screen and the screen as site of illegibility. The collapsing together of the fascinating illegibility of the woman and that of the screen. The anxieties surrounding the diminishing power of the face as anchor of representation in a highly mediated society are exhibited differently in narrative cinema and the avant-garde. But we have to question whether, ultimately, the sexual politics of this avant-garde and of mass culture are not dangerously tangential, whether the female figure becomes in both the sign or symptom of the failure of recognition and of intersubjectivity, whether a curiously modern fear of prosopagnosia infiltrates both domains, reducing their difference, producing an affinity, any discussion of politics and aesthetics, any politics of reading must confront. Thank you. Yes, definitely.
So we have to invite questions from the
I'm thinking of some of Warhol's other films, such as E, or other films that are centered on a male face. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you would just be interested to hear your thoughts about play of light and shadow, and whether he doesn't do that with male.
Which
faces.
Film are you talking about?
Is that the Blowjob?
Oh, sorry, Blowjob.
Blowjob.
No, right.
Okay,
right.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think Blowjob is very, very different. Blowjob is very much about what is outside the frame and framing, the question of framing. And it does have to do with the readability of the face, right? I mean, that's what you're constantly doing. You know the title, you see the film, you assume what's happening, but you also believe that you see it on the face. Now, nothing could be happening outside of the frame, right? But it is about the legibility and the readability of the face. And I don't think that that's what's going on, really, in Chelsea Girls with Nico's face. What's fascinating to me about that scene has to do with the way that the face becomes the screen and sort of the surface of a projection and the sight of something that is unreadable. I mean, that is about illegibility itself. In Blowjob, there's a sense in which reading that face is almost like reading Scotty's face in Vertigo, which, of course, is a very expressive face, and so the registration of loss and desire is just, painfully evident on it. So that the male face in that kind of situation, and, I'm not going to say this is always the case, but I can't think of any. I'd love to hear examples, where the male face is used in quite the same way as a screen. But in those examples, the male face is really about knowledge. And almost, the face actually, certainly in Vertigo, the face of Scotty is a guarantee of knowledge. It's a guarantee that you, I mean, it makes you comfortable to at least know that you know what he's thinking, or you believe you know what he's thinking. You believe there's an interiority, you know, that you can read the surface and you can get beyond it to the interiority itself. So there's something, despite the, you know, the destabilizing aspects of vertigo, there's something that's very reassuring about his characterization, at least as far as Scotty is concerned.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you press the question of Warhol perhaps a little differently. I mean, in both the sort of historical moment of Man Ray and then this recent historical moment of Warhol, you're dealing with two figures who move between the still and the living image. And in Warhol's case, the other medium is the silk screen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's through the medium of the silk screen that he's engaging any number of faces, male and female, and onto any number of different sort of scenarios. So I'm wondering how that sort of persistence of the screen across his work, both filmic and artistic, plays into this in some way. And how the silk screen functions,
That's an excellent question. I mean, mostly it's celebrities, right, and the silk screens. I think the screen there plays a different role. But I actually, you know, you're the first one who's ever asked me about that, and I haven't really thought about it. I have to think about it for a while, but my sort of immediate reaction, which I might rethink later, would be that what's partially important here is movement, is the projection of movement on, you know, the face of the woman, and that it's difficult. And also, it's not just that, it's got to do with the scale of the image and the cinema as sort of a public spectacle in an auditorium, you know, ideally projected larger than life. That the imposition of the face as screen and the function of the screen in terms of exhibition, public exhibition in a theatrical space is really crucial to the kind of thing that I'm talking about. I mean, I think Warhol is, you know, extremely interesting in many ways. And, you know, the silk screens and the engagement with commodification is very, very interesting. But I think as well as Godard. I mean, I would say the same about Godard. I mean, in many ways, he's quite critical. His work is really revolutionary for the period. The reason I'm fascinated with them, I guess, is that this image, you know, sort of pops up. And why? You know, why is it conceivable only in terms of the female face? Why is it, you know, the female face that acts in this particular kind of way? Now, obviously, I think it plays into a long history of representation of the female face, but I do think that there's something quite specific to the 20th century that's going on here that has to do with the mediation of faces, faces as the ground of recognizability, and a felt loss or anxiety surrounding that.
Mm-hmm. I thank you so much for your talk, and I have two questions. I'm trying to put them together. One is about the recognizability of celebrity faces and the way that the stars work in the clips that you showed, and also in, say, a theorist like Balazs, where he's talking about the face of man, but he's also talking about close-ups very specifically around a certain kind of performance. And so I want to just say a little bit more about that in terms of maybe a different kind of faciality that we have by, you know, an imagined, maybe projected interiority for somebody like Nico or Castellanesi or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to connect it to an image that just popped in my mind when you showed Vertigo, which is the credit sequence of Vertigo.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's a sort of mass culture image, it's Vertigo, but it's also avant-garde because it's animated.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a woman who is not Kim Novak, although Kim Novak's name comes up to the rest of the credits in the film, and is not any of the other blondes or, you know, people of that she's not recognizable as a celebrity, but she's very much the object of the kinds of projections that you're talking about, but maybe in a different way. So I wonder if you thought at all about that credit sequence in Vertigo, and then maybe about whether recognizing the face from the intimacy that we have with a star face, it is different from some of the uses of the avant-garde sort of models, although some of those avant-garde women are also really
The opening of Vertigo, you're talking about the spiral coming out of the eye and the... that's not Kim Novak, huh?
No.
Okay. I have to look at that again. I guess I've always assumed it. I have to look at it again to see, but I don't... It's, for me, it's kind of stream of consciousness move from your one question to the other. Okay. Because I don't know whether what's important about that scene has to do with the star status, or why actually, you know, one would expect it to be Kim Novak, because, in fact, it should be Scotty, right? Scotty is the one who suffers from vertigo. Scotty is the one who has this dysfunction of the gaze, and so there's a sense in which it may help to prove, you know, the argument that that it is the woman's face, whether it's anonymous or a celebrity or a star face, that's absolutely crucial. Your question about the star and the difference between stars and non-stars, It obviously makes a difference insofar as the face is recognized in a certain kind of way, right? So the recognizability of Nico, which is both internal and external to this film, right? I mean, she's known from all kinds of different venues, but even within this film, if you watch the entire thing, she appears in the very first scene where her bangs are incessantly cut. So you have that form of recognition at the outset, doubled by the star recognition. And it may be just that there's a kind of doubling of the process of dismantling recognition if you begin with a face that's already highly recognizable. And that with the star, there's a sense in which, you know, the assault on recognizability might be felt more acutely than it would if you didn't know the face in the first place.
You mentioned Letter to Jane as another possible point of comparison, and it made me think about two things, thinking about Letter to Jane in comparison to Chelsea Girls and the clip that you showed in particular. So one of the things that I was thinking about was the question of what difference it makes whether the face, the female face being shown, is a photographic image, a two-dimensional photographic image being filmed and explored by a moving camera, or a three-dimensional face being turned into a two-dimensional image and then having something projected onto it. But also in both of those films, sound is really important, I think, to framing the screen space.
Both of the films being...
Letter to Jane and Chelsea Girls, and particularly these two clips, because you have... in Letter to Jane, you have these two male voices that have no faces talking about this
face and
asking questions that she can't respond. But then in Chelsea Girls, you have Nico as a silent face, even though she's moving in a film with a three-dimensional face.
Well, it's not three-dimensional, but it's moving,
right,
okay.
Right. The face itself is not a photograph, is what I mean.
Right, yes.
But then on the other screen, you have both Undine's voice and face that's able to move in and out, but you also have, is it Edie Sedgwick, the other voice? There's a female voice.
Oh, I don't know who, actually, I have to look that up.
There's a female voice without a face.
Yes,
in the way that it frames that silent face. So I wanted to say something maybe about both.
You know, there is a point in that scene, I'm pretty sure, maybe somebody can correct me, when she actually comes into the frame. I think there is. But anyway, go on.
I guess I'm asking you both, what difference does does the screen face have to be silent? And also, what difference does it make if it's a photograph or a film of a face?
I haven't yet. Oh, actually, I have. I was going to say, I haven't yet found an instance of this happening where there's sound or speech or singing, for instance. But there was there's a wonderful clip, which I'm sure many of you have seen, that I would have liked to work into this, but I already had too many clips anyway, and it was already too long anyway. But it's from Busby Berkeley's Gold Diggers of 1935, and it's a very famous sequence called Lullaby of Broadway. And in it, it begins with kind of blackness in the shot, and then there's a very small face, a woman's face that seems to be distant, right, that comes closer and closer until it's in full close-up, and it's singing Lullaby of Broadway. And the amazing thing about this scene is that it then turns upside down, puts a cigarette in its mouth, and then the face is transformed into a kind of screen or even a kind of keyhole in a way, where what you see is a very clearly artificial picture of the city. And then you move into the city, you move into daily life, and then you move into this entire scenario about a woman who stays up, only gets up very late, and then stays up all night and dances all night, and it ends in a really strange way with her death as she falls off a balcony, and then it goes back and it's framed with the same face with the city imaged inside it with a cigarette, and it turns and the cigarette comes out and that kind of thing. And it's the singing voice again. So I don't think that it's necessary that it not, you know, song obviously is quite different from dialogue or discourse or whatever. So I wouldn't say that it's exactly the same, but it's at least one instance I've seen where sound is incorporated in. And what was the other question?
You can take another question, but it was about the photograph.
The photograph, yeah. Well, you know, when I came to the part about Letter to Jane and said, well, I don't have time, so, you obviously say that when you haven't done it yet. So I've always been fascinated by Letter to Jane, and I am going to take a look at it, and I will think, I think what you said just now about the fact that she is voiceless, you know, she's deprived of both movement and the voice is a form of movement across time, whereas you have these two males talking about her who are faceless, is a really, really interesting, comment on it. But I'm not sure that, in Letter to Jane, it's not so much, I think, that she acts as a screen, although in a way she does, I guess, because what's important to them at one point is the history of a look, right? And they cite Henry Fonda as being one in The Grapes of Wrath as exemplifying this look, this sort of benign, liberal look of concern that does nothing. And there are other faces as well, and some of them are male. But the interesting thing is that she, in that sense, acts as a kind of screen for the history of those faces, because she's reenacting in a way, or she's exemplifying for them this this ineffectual, liberal look. But I have to think about it more.
I just wanted to ask again about the classic scene of this recognition and this question of resemblance face. And I know you were quoting when you were talking about resemblance through the face, but I was sort of wondering about that question of resemblance in those scenes, because clearly there's a lot of resemblance going on, right? It's just not, it's not the face.
Which scenes?
In the classic face of the crowd.
Oh, yes.
The crowd, right?
Yes, but yes.
That's with bearing and clothing and
yes.
Sort of everything but the face, right? The face is much more.
But the face is, go ahead.
Well, so I was just sort of wondering about, you can have resemblance with misrecognition, right? That's what those scenes are about. So how does that, I guess sort of more broadly in thinking about theorizing the face, how do you think about resemblance? And I guess it sort of also speaks to all of the female, headless female torsos that are sort of interchangeable in the avant-garde tradition. So I don't know if there's anything you can say about that.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's Aumont who talks about resemblance and resemblance being linked you know, completely to the face, that the face is the ground of resemblance and therefore the ground of representation. And I'm not sure I would entirely go along with him, but I think there's something to it. In the trope of the turn in the Hollywood cinema, when the man is looking for a specific woman and, you know, he sees things that, you know, obviously act as markers of resemblance. The hairdo is one that Joe Milutis makes a big deal of. And obviously in this scene, it was the clothes, it was the car, you know, at least with in Vertigo in the first one. In the second, it was the hair, it was the clothes. But what is interesting is that the marker of decidability is the face. That when the woman turns or comes into the light, or is, you know, when her face is visible, that's when he knows that he's made a mistake. And so I don't think that those particular examples actually disprove anything that Aumont says. But what Aumont is saying, it goes much further back. I mean, he's saying something essential, you know, about representation that seems to me to be somewhat trans-historical, right? And no matter what you have that resembles, it's always the face that is crucial in an anthropocentric, you know, kind of moment. And particularly when you say that one person resembles another, you know, it's the face that's really the marker of that most of the time, if not all of the time, actually. And so I think that there is something to that analysis about the sort of crucial nature of the face in recognition, resemblance, identity. And it's one of the reasons that it's yoked so strongly to the notion of individuality. I'll take more. I'm not too tired right now. I don't know how long you have the space for, but okay. There's one here.
I was struck by this question. This one of the things that you showed that Godard is a moment where there's a recognition about the resemblance of the two women. There's the Falconet in the screen and then there's Anna Karina. And I'm kind of struck by how different that scene was, because it's the one in which you actually see a spectator, a female spectator, looking at another image. At that moment, there's a transfer back that we cannot possibly have seen in the other examples, because we are sort of looking at the moments without taking the incorporated spectators into the account. So I'm trying to see, like...
I'm not sure I understand.
In the other examples, sort of...
Oh, okay. The other examples that I used.
The other examples, we're looking at images on the screen, and that's often what the movies that they're also talking about. We don't... At no point do we go and sort of look at the spectator looking at the scene.
Right. It is very different in the sense that you've outlined, which is that it incorporates an image of the spectator looking at the face. And it's, you know, to some extent, it's definitely about mimesis or identification, right? She identifies, you know, with Falconetti. The tears stream down her face as well. There's kind of over-identification in a sense. So that's what is at least partially at issue there. But I'm not really so much concerned with the process of identification that is clearly subject to, if not a critique, some kind of analysis or investigation, as with the question of a screening and then a meta-screening in a way, because Anna Karina then becomes screened for us, right? And she is, in a way, the barrier of the effects of an image of a woman screened. So it's almost a kind of meta-commentary on it, but it's not the one that, it seems to me, is crucial for Godard there. But it's certainly, in some ways, is very, very similar, I think, to the other examples. Mm-hmm.
thinking about a man's face as a screen, I had two thoughts. One is, in the clip from Iman Bakir you showed, the face wasn't actually a literal screen. It was part of a dissolve back and forth. I think in those terms of film noir, there are a lot of cases where men's faces have been superposed with or dissolved into other images. So in that model, I can think of examples. But and also, isn't there a trope of men walking in front of projected lectures or films or something like Citizen Kane?
But that's the entire figure, I think, most of the time. I mean, I can't think of any examples where...
Peeping Tom.
Well, it's the woman who walks in front of the screen in Peeping Tom. But the point about the dissolve is really a good one, and I thought about that, you know, and I haven't resolved it yet necessarily, but I think there is... that it's not just a dissolve is not just a dissolve here, that there is, particularly in the last case with the woman's face, the woman's own face projected over her face. And I'm not sure that the fact that, I mean, a dissolve is just a superimposed fade in and fade out. I'm not sure that that in itself counters the notion that her face acts as a screen. When in film noir, I'm not sure what you're thinking of, but I'm thinking of, when you say that, I'm thinking of, like, drunken sequences or drugged or, you know, hallucinatory sequences. But it seems to me that that's a point of view construction, where you have the man looking and then you see distortions and hallucinations and swirlings of the screen and lights. And that is his point of view because he's been drugged or... has been made drunk against his will or is drunk or something like that. So I don't know. Are you thinking of other types of...
There are some that are not going to do it. There, in DOA, it's the face of someone coming out of a stupor, but it's a past event that's taking place.
Okay. I have to check that out, DOA. I don't remember the film well enough to... but I will. Okay, I'm tired.